Hello, I'm Sarah Knoski, sitting in for Richard Feidler on Conversations for the next 2 weeks. Amal Ahwad is my guest today. When Amal was growing up in Sydney, she kept a glory box, filling it with china and Tupperware and lingerie, things she'd need when she married a good Muslim boy with an Arab background just like her own. This is one of the things that didn't work out the way Amal or her family planned. Amal Ahwad is a journalist and a novelist. Her latest book is Beyond Veiled Clichés, The Real Lives of Arab Women. Hi, Amal. Welcome to Conversations.
Hi, Sarah. Thank you for having me.
Amal, so what are the clichés about Arab women that bug you the most?
The veiled woman on the cover of a book, frightened eyes peeking out, always with this beautiful eyeliner, but, you know, she looks miserable. Meek, silent, powerless. They're the main issues that I have with Arab women in terms of how they're portrayed, especially in pop culture. So I grew up watching movies and television like everyone else. I love reading. I never really saw Arab women reflected in a very human, normal way. They were always reflected in a way that just, I guess, fed the perception that already existed, that they are there in sort of in relation to a man. So they were the long-suffering wife or the daughter or, you know, the daughter who wants to rebel or, you know, just things that were limiting.
So whereabouts did you grow up?
I grew up in Sydney. I was born in Sydney. I grew up in the eastern suburbs, which is probably not a very predominantly Arab area.
How did your parents end up there?
When my dad came to Sydney, it wasn't so, I guess, segmented. You didn't have these clear demarcations yet of where sort of this area is very Asian, this area is very Arab. And so a lot of Arabs at the time were coming and they were out in the eastern suburbs, southwestern suburbs, just taking whatever work they could get. And my parents, when my father married my mother, they were still sort of in that area of Sydney. And I think my father just really loved the fact that it was just near the water and all of this. And so he just said, I'm going to stay here. And he didn't move or migrate to another suburb the way a lot of his friends did.
Where did they come from before Sydney?
My parents are both Palestinian. My mother was living in Kuwait when she got together with my father. My father comes from a town in Palestine called Arabi. And my mum is from Jenin. So they're quite close to each other. Jenin is probably a bit more well-known than Arabi. but my father actually left and went to Germany and lived in Germany for a couple of years and worked there before he made it to Australia. He came by himself, went back to Kuwait on the recommendation, I think, of someone in the family who said, you should meet Samia, who's my mum. And they got married and he brought my mum here.
And then how many kids once they came to Australia?
There's five of us now. I have three older brothers, one younger brother, and I'm the only girl. My name is Amal, which means hope, which is my mother's hope that she would have a girl. Apparently that's what she told me, and I believe her. She's had three boys. She wanted a girl, finally. I think my father as well wanted a girl, so.
And your family, were they religious or are they religious?
I'm not sure if religious is the right word. They're definitely observant. My parents are observant Muslims. I always question sort of what the word religious means as an adult. I think there's this huge sort of melding of culture and religion. And I think they're influenced by culture as much as religion in some ways. I would definitely describe my parents as conservative people. I think they're a lot more open-minded now, and I don't know how much of that is forced upon them because they've brought kids up in a country that's not their own and they've had to adjust.
What about your education into Islam? You went to Saturday school. What did you learn there?
It was mainly just some poor teacher from Lebanon trying to teach us Arabic and try to teach us verses from the Quran. And I was really young. I was probably 4 or 5, maybe 6, let's say. I just had no idea what was going on. My brothers were a bit older, and so they were already praying, and so eventually I would learn to pray. But I just couldn't read the writing. I didn't know what was going on. And so he would just try to, I guess, teach us verses at first. And then as the Saturday school expanded, it probably became a bit more focused on the language as well. I was well behaved, but I don't think I was really there to learn. I was there because my brothers were there, because all the older kids were there, and I was so excited to be part of this group. And it was just fun because I don't know, like when you grow up with brothers especially, you just want to be like them. You just want to do what they're doing. And here was this legit way to do it. Like my parents weren't going to say, no, you can't play with the boys, because they were sending me there. So I got to be a part of this really cool club for a little while. But I don't know how much of us really, like how many of us really took away what we were meant to learn. But, you know, eventually all of us were learning how to pray and all of that. So it didn't really matter in the end.
And what did your dad do for a living?
What didn't he do? My dad was that ultimate entrepreneur. You know, he came and he learned so many skills. He was a gardener. He owned a video store at one stage. He would hire out like, you know, Arabic films, and then he extended that to Western films, so Hollywood films. And so I grew up in a video store is how I think of it. My brothers and I love movies to this day. We're such film buffs, and we just had them at our disposal. And I mean, I was five, so Strawberry Shortcake was obviously high on the list, but I just remember seeing Hollywood as this really magical kind of place of sort of these stories coming to life. And as I got older, I even went backwards in my Hollywood viewing. I would watch the older movies with all the, you know, Ginger Rogers and Katharine Hepburn and all these amazing women. And strangely enough, I connected to them quite a lot, because they were like really proper movies. There was nothing in them that was offensive or dangerous. You know, my parents walked in and I was watching these movies. I never had to change the channel. So I really related to these women. I always saw myself as a dame in waiting, really.
Yeah, well, these are incredibly smart, independent, tough women in men's worlds, I guess.
They absolutely were. I think that Hollywood had it right, you know, years ago in that sense. So they weren't the worst role models, actually, when I think about it.
When you were growing up, going to school, going to public school with other kids in Sydney's eastern suburbs, did you feel that your childhood was particularly different from those kids that you were in classes with?
In some ways, yes, and in some ways, no. I'm eternally grateful that my parents did put me in public school for the first sort of 9 or 10 years, because I think it makes you, I don't know if hard is the right word, but you can sort of just deal with the world a little bit better, I think, in public school, because you're not sheltered. And I think the differences started to pop up more with interaction with the opposite sex. So if there was a party and it was mixed, I wasn't allowed to go. And I didn't really understand that at first. I think I was a really bolshy kid, though. When I look at myself at 5, 6, 7, whatever, I was probably a really feisty 5-year-old, and it just didn't occur to me that there were limitations. I just thought the world is there and just enjoy it. And I think as I got older, it did get harder, because it was sort of like, okay, well, now you're getting too old for swimsuits at the beach. And so there were absolutely were challenges in that sense, because it's very difficult. It's sort of like I always think of it as being taken into a chocolate store and you're diabetic and you're not allowed to eat, or, you know, you're not allowed to pick what you want from that shelf. So it was definitely challenging in some ways.
What's seeing all those other experiences around you and not being able to engage with them?
Well, just trying to understand with that sort of young brain of yours why you're different. Because your parents are trying to protect you. They're trying to say, this isn't the way I want you to do something. But you're like 5, 7, 10, whatever. What are they going to tell you that's going to make sense to you, except this is forbidden, this is not allowed, this is not how we do something? And so you're actually not really understanding it. You're just you're obeying it. And I don't think I really understood normality. I didn't really understand what was normal until one day I realized that, especially because I was reading a lot, I was always reading a different kind of normal. And whether it's in a movie or a book, or even if it's in your actual everyday life, you start to feel like you're an observer of the world rather than in it in some ways. And if you're learning that from a really young age, and it's not that my parents did anything wrong by me, I think that they were just really trying to protect me from being hurt. And I can see that as an adult now. But I think that it can be very difficult when you're growing up to understand that, because you just want to do things like everyone else.
You use that word forbidden. Tell me a bit more about that and its way that it was explained to you by your parents.
I don't know that it was really explained. There's an Arabic word, haram, which is forbidden. So, you know, halal is permissible. So, you know, if meat is halal, you know, that means it's permissible meat or whatever. So haram is like it's opposite. And it was very common to ask your parents to do something and they say, that's haram. That was the explanation you were given.
Like what sort of things are haram?
Oh, like going to a concert, you can do that. Mixing with boys. And I would say that the same applied for my brother's. It's just that it's a bit different for boys. They could still get away with a little bit more, I think. So they didn't have the swimsuit regulation, for example, because men don't have to cover up, whereas girls do. Of course, like I said, I'm not trying to say what my parents did was right or wrong. It was their choice. They are my parents and they have the right to raise me how they want, as long as it's not dangerous to me. And if anything, they kept me very safe. But I think that the issue with the word haram sometimes is you grow up not really knowing how to differentiate between what is genuinely dangerous and what is just not right or appropriate. Mm-hmm. And so you have to learn to configure those ideas in your own mind. And you will eventually if you are growing as you should. And my parents always emphasized the importance of my education. They never tried to limit me in ways that would see me grow in the world. I would completely say that. And I think that's a really important point because I think that they always knew deep down, well, she's going to have to make up her mind for herself one day, but in the meantime, we're going to protect her. And I would say it was the same for my brothers. I don't think that they had a free ticket and I was like, you're a boy, you can do everything. It wasn't like that. I think we grew up like a lot of Arab kids in a really sort of guarded way. It was very protective. And that's the word I would use now. I think restrictive is a very negative word. It was restrictive, but I do feel it was also protective.
What about high school, Amal? Where did you go to high school?
My parents invested in my education very heavily and sent me to a private school called Kambala. And it was an eastern suburbs school. And I guess it was a really interesting place to be in a lot of ways. It wasn't, as I said, there weren't a lot of Arab girls at that school. And I think around that time, I went in year six. I would say in my high school years, I was really coming to terms with my identity or identities as an Arab, as a Muslim, especially as a Palestinian woman who was witnessing a lot of injustice in the world and trying to make sense of, well, what's the contribution I can make here? And you've got to understand my parents were actually taking me back to the Middle East for visits, to visit family. So I had this connection there. And so it was this really strange experience, high school, because I always felt like I saw other worlds or other things that a lot of the people around me didn't. And this isn't to sort of diminish the lives of anyone else around me. We were just very different. I don't know that I saw the world the way a lot of people around me did.
I guess that's common for a lot of immigrant kids or kids growing up with parents who've come from a different culture. Did you feel though that you had that connection with other members of your community who were there at school with you?
I didn't have any Arab friends at school. I definitely had Greek friends. I think I had the most in common with them. They had the...
I'm sure there's a Greek word for haram that's very important in many Greek households.
I should ask my best friend about that, actually. She's Greek. You know what it was? It was that they had the weekend chores, the weekend commitments. They did the dancing, the Greek dancing. They had a second language. They had parents who were like, no sleepovers. So I could completely relate to those girls. We weren't like the other girls who just... It was just a different kind of world that we were brought up in. One thing that people don't really get with the migrant experience is for all of the restrictiveness that you might see or hear about, it is a very loving bubble. You know, it's a cultural loving bubble, which introduces you to different things. It's like seeing 20 layers instead of 10. And it kind of diminishes the severity of that restriction because you're benefiting at the same time. You're getting things, not just having things taken away. And that's where the migrant experience, I think, for kids of migrants, that's where we can relate to each other. We have these other things, these holidays, these foods, these odd quirks. Our parents are all really funny. You know, they say weird things or they, you know, we had these things in common. And so absolutely, I think I sought that out. If it was conscious or subconscious, either way, I easily befriended people who had similar lives.
What did you want to do when you finished year 12?
I always said I was going to do law. I really wanted to be a journalist. There was no doubt in my mind that I wanted to write for a living. I'm somebody who I think I don't know why, but I take a really long way to get to my destination. And so maybe I needed to go through that law degree to really understand how much I didn't want to be a lawyer. But either way, I finished high school And my dad, I think he'd invested so much in my education. And so when I said, well, I want to do communications, he was like, what is that? What is communications? And he said, you got the marks, do law. And so I just said, okay, you know, he's got a point. My father's point was always very simple. He's like, I never want you to be reliant on anyone. I want you to be able to stand on your own two feet and have a solid career for yourself and not have to, like, he didn't know, he didn't have a crystal ball. And I think his fear was, who knows what's going to happen to my daughter in the future? Who will she end up with, if anyone? And if she does, what if he's not a good man? I want her to be able to support herself. And so I actually think my father was really just looking out for me when he said, be a lawyer, because it's a solid career. And I just don't think I was convinced myself that I really knew what I would do with the journalism degree. So I said, okay, I'll do law. So I think it was a very kind of business-like discussion with my parents, because I was 18 and ready to, you know, just go out into the world.
Well, let's talk about that period when you're sort of 18 and then moving into your 20s, because for many of us, that's the time when we start, I guess, forming our own sense of ourselves, maybe moving away from our family, moving away from a childhood world, probably having a few disastrous relationships or so. What were your 20s like? Did they resemble that script?
Not at all. Not at all. My early 20s, I kind of decided, I think by the time I finished my degree, I'd had a lot of big things happen. One of them was that I lost someone to cancer who was very close, like I was close to my uncle and he passed away, and it sort of affected me quite deeply. I was becoming more religious. I was also just really wanting to be a bit of a hermit, and I just found myself isolating myself a lot, sitting in my room, watching my movies, reading my books. I know it sounds funny, I just said I was more religious, but I never gave up on my storytelling dreams. I actually don't think I had a lot of aspirations for myself. If I'm being completely honest, I don't know what I was thinking, but I probably was just simplifying my life. Mm. I felt like wanting things was too hard. I didn't feel in control of my life or in control of my destiny. I didn't know what I felt about certain things. When I look back now, that's what I think was happening. And so I had friends who were traveling the world, and, you know, one of my close friends lost her mother, and it was just these big things were happening, and it was like you weren't sheltered anymore. And so I wanted to live this very safe existence where I didn't have to be hurt by the world. Of course, that's not possible. And so eventually I did open up my life to, I guess, other Muslims especially. I started to get online and, you know, interact with other Muslims in sort of Australia, especially a couple of people overseas. That changed my life. I don't think I had many aspirations, because I think I was a true romantic. I honestly thought, I'm just going to get married and have kids. I don't know why. I don't see anything wrong with that.
But it's all those Hollywood movies you were watching.
I don't know what it was. Maybe it's because I was never allowed to date as a teenager. So I just thought I had a very sort of rosy view of all these things. And people used to think I was an idiot at uni. They would say, oh, you know, she's the idiot who wants to get married. And of course, they all wanted to get married, these Muslim kids. They just didn't admit it out loud. And I have no filter. I'm such an honest person. I did meet people through the lounge room sort of setting. What would happen is, you know, a family friend would say to my father, well, this guy's looking for a wife. Can he come and meet your daughter? And so my friend gave me this phrase, and I've always used it to this day now, at door knock appeals. So, you know, this guy would come to your house, and it was just the most awkward setup ever, because, you know, you'd serve tea and biscuits and all the sort of thing, and my father would just be really friendly and talking. And
so this was the effort to find you a husband when you're a good Muslim Arab girl and you can't date. The men come to you, literally.
Yeah, literally. They would come to you with their parents, or if he was from overseas, he'd come with whoever referred him.
And how often would this happen, Emma?
Look, you know, your stock plummets as you get older. So I would say...
In your heyday.
My heyday. I would say, look, it wasn't like weekly or anything. Maybe from the 18 to 24 bracket, a few a year. So you'd see maybe four.
So it was quite serious. If someone actually, if they were going to be allowed to come and visit, they were a contender.
Oh, not really. Like, on paper, yes, because, you know, on paper they've ticked boxes. It's like, okay, well, this person's recommended them, and it's very Jane Austen, you know, because I always felt so much kinship with the Jane Austen characters, you know, Mr. Bingley, and, you know, I don't know, it was very much like that. He has £5,000 a year, you know, that kind of silly.
And an estate in Suffolk, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and it was, it really does, because you've got to, you're looking at suitability at a basic level before you even contemplate chemistry and emotions.
And is this something you and your parents would look at together? Like you'd discuss someone's viability or not before you'd agree to meet them, or were they people that your parents had chosen as possible?
No, my parents never forced anyone. They were always like, this family recommends this person, or has, you know, would like this guy to meet you. He's this, this, and this, and he does that, and he lives there, and, you know, do you want to meet him? And the funny thing about those door knock appeals was that a lot of the time, you just get so used to disappointment, because you think, come on, something's got to give. And really, it just, you can't force something like that. And my mum especially, she was just really tough, I think, on these guys, because she was like, I'm not going to give my daughter over to just anyone. So I credit my parents a lot with the fact that they tried to open up my world in a safe way and, you know, sort of help me to meet people, but they never, ever forced me. They never, I think my father got a little bit flustered at one point when I was sort of heading towards the other end of my 20s, and he's like, what do you want? And I said, oh, I just want special. He's like, what does that mean? And I'm like, I have no idea. Just know that it's not anyone that's come so far. And so it's this awkward setup. It's like a date, except 20 people are present, not 20, but let's say
your parents are
your
present.
Parents, his parents, sometimes a sibling or two from his side. It's a delicate thing, because you can't show too much personality, because then it's going to be like, look at this girl, she's desperate for him. And at the same time, if you don't show any personality, there's no way that you're going to connect with this person. So it was this kind of weird thing, and I learnt a lot, I think, in the process, because I remember there was one particular guy who, he knew someone at uni with me and had asked about me, but it wasn't in a nice way. It was almost like, is she good or is she bad? And I remember just feeling really angry, because it just didn't feel right that this guy was getting the tick of approval on me, my personality, my heart, my soul, from a guy who didn't even know me. This guy at uni barely knew me. I actually just grew out of doing those altogether.
Tell me about, I think it was the last man you were formally introduced to in this way. What happened there?
This is the Quaidy pilot. He was referred to us by a friend, and by that point we'd just ditched the lounge room. My parents were like, we're just going to a coffee shop somewhere. And we'd outgrown it. I was still living at home though. I hadn't moved out yet. So We met up with this man, and he walked in, and he just, I mean, look, I wasn't attracted to him at first, which isn't a big deal for me. I don't really care about the external look so much. I really believe you get to know someone and that's what's going to make you attracted to a person. But there was just something about him that was a little bit too polished, a little bit too, you know, he just tried to say all the right things. And my mum, a sort of eternally suspicious person, just was like, well, I've lived in Kuwait, and what about this place, and what about, and his answers didn't really stack up in her mind. And he obviously, I guess, understood that we didn't really get who are you, which family are you from, blah, blah, blah. And so he delivered this whole manila folder full of documents proving his identity to our place. And I was talking to my best friend about it, and she's like, I don't know, is that a pretty bad start? And she'd also said to me, like, what do you think of him? Was he nice? Was he well presented? Did he dress well? And I said, yeah, so well that it looked like the tags were still on his clothing. And that, to me, I think I'd just become that cynical by that point. I mean, having said that, I got to know him a little bit, and his attitudes just started to show through a little bit, and I thought, no, this is not, I actually don't need to do this anymore. I don't think I'm searching for that right now. I was searching for something else, something deeper, which was myself and understanding myself. So I think I would have been late 20s by that point, and I just went, I'm not doing this anymore. And blissfully, the requests stopped coming, so I didn't have to think about it anymore. And I think my parents were almost like, you know what, just stay single, just enjoy your life, be free, you know. And it was, yeah, it just was not, that experience put me off, because I felt like I had outgrown the need to please someone I didn't even know.
Is this the time that you were also starting a glory box, Amal, which isn't so common anymore? What did you put in your glory box?
Was actually a wall in the dining room of my parents' home. And I think it actually began in my 20s, in my early 20s. And I just love, I have a real fascination and love of mugs, to the point that if somebody...
Sorry, you need to repeat that for me. Did you say fascination and a love of mugs?
I do. I love a really nice mug. And so what would happen is, like, if somebody goes to a different country I've never been to, they'll come back with a mug for me. So I have like 30, 40 mugs now that never get used, by the way. But in my 20s, though, if I saw like a really nice set of mugs or teacups or cutlery or something, I would be like, that's really nice. That would be great in my future home. And so I would just buy all this stuff. And it was too good to use. Like, I'm not going to touch this yet. There's four of them. There's only one of me. So I would just stack these things and not realize how much they were accumulating. And then I had what I call a 5-minute engagement in my 20s, which is when I was getting to know someone. And we got engaged, quote unquote, but then it ended pretty quickly. And I'd probably bought a few more things in that period of time thinking, cool, I get to use this. I get to break out these bad boys. And it didn't happen. And when I actually moved out of home, I did a stock take and realized how much stuff I had accumulated.
How many mugs?
Mugs, plates, Tupperware, serving dishes. And I don't know. Like, I look back now and I don't look at myself and think, oh God, what a loser. I just think that's really cute. Like, what were you waiting for? You could have used those things when you were in your 20s and just at home. It didn't matter. And I think it's a really interesting sort of metaphor almost for the way we think about things in our lives. It's like, I have to wait for something to happen before I can enjoy this. And it was almost like I wasn't dating, so it was sort of the one contribution I could put towards. It was almost like a manifestation vision board, if I think about it now. It was like, this is me creating my future right now. Of course, one day I woke up and realized I could create a much more vibrant and interesting future than cutlery and mugs. And of course, that takes a lot of time and courage, and you have to go through a lot of heartbreak. And I don't mean just romantic heartbreak, to understand that you are not living life to your full capacity.
Amal, you were describing living at home, amassing this not glory box but glory wall, waiting for this husband to appear. When he did finally appear, this man that you were to get married to, where did you find him?
Well, he'd actually been in my life for a couple of years, so he was hiding in plain sight. I eventually did get married in my mid-30s. To a man who I'd worked with for a couple of years, and it had not been romantic at all when we worked together, obviously. It was. I think we had a good friendship, and then we both left that job, and then one day we'd met up, and he was encouraging me to find a new job somewhere, and something changed, and it was like, oh, okay. And it was really difficult because he wasn't Arab, he wasn't Muslim, and so it was like, what do I do with this? And yeah, he was sort of, I just did not expect that. I did not expect it. It was this weird thing where I think I'd just come to a point of almost complete peace with myself. I just surrendered to life at that time. And it was, you know, when people always say to you, oh, you know, this will happen when you least expect it. What that really means is when you stop thinking about something, you've surrendered. You've said, I'm not going to try to control the outcome here. And by that point, I really understood the importance of, I guess, self-love, not to sound cheesy, but you've got nothing in life if you don't have your own back, if you don't really care about yourself and how your day goes. You're not going to find somebody, or you can, but they're not going to necessarily be someone who's at ease with themselves either.
So what do you think you saw in Chris that wasn't there with those men who were turning up at your parents' lounge room? What was it about him that you responded to?
I think the big difference was, I always felt like when I was meeting a man, it was that I was filling a role. I was going to be his wife. I don't think Chris saw me as a wife in waiting. It was that I saw a man who was, he was Chris. He likes these things. He's an individual in his own right. And the best way I can describe it is that we were two individuals coming together, and it wasn't about completing each other or any of that sort of cheesy stuff. Whereas I think that when I was looking at marriage from the viewpoint of someone who'd never interacted really with men in any meaningful way, I had a very naive idea of what it meant to be a wife. And I understood now that it's not this role to fill. It's actually just a label that you give to yourself when you get together with someone. He was just a very kind person. He really believed in me. I felt like he didn't feel threatened by my goals or my aspirations in life. I feel like that was the big difference for me, that he didn't look at his life in relation to mine and say, you need to do this to make me happy, or vice versa. Like, it was just, there was respect for my journey. Mm.
Given that you hadn't had those experiences dating or being in relationships with other guys, was it sort of tricky to know how to go about doing that by the time you're in your early 30s?
Of course. I mean, you don't really ever date as an Arab girl. You just get to know people. And I think I really struggled getting to know Chris because I couldn't just be the girlfriend that he would have maybe been used to. And that's the thing that usually would end something before it began with other people, whereas he wasn't like that. He felt convinced that there was something there. And I think he was just certain enough that it was enough for both of us when I needed him to be certain. Because I said to him, you know I'm Muslim. That was how I said it. You know I'm Muslim. Because he'd worked with me for 2 years. He'd seen the way I lived. And sort of, I told him a lot of things about my life. I did no idea he was going to be my husband one day. And he just said, look, if we can put a man on the moon, I think we can make this work.
That's a good answer.
I can't argue with that.
What about your parents? How were they when you first introduced this non-Muslim, non-Arab?
I like to think that they were numb now when I first knew. They initially responded very calmly and just said, okay, well, all right, this day was going to happen. I think that's what was happening in their minds. But they had obviously deep concerns. My mother was very frightened that she wants to marry a guy who's not Arab. He's not going to understand our culture. She knew he could convert to Islam, but he could never be Arab. I think with my dad, they were very practical concerns. He wanted to be able to say, well, this man has a home that he can live in with my daughter, and he, you know, he's saved this much money, or he's got a car, and Chris, like, had a bicycle. You know, he just rode to work every day and, you know, was focused on being fit and all this sort of, it was just very funny. Like, I think for all of the plainness that I had in my life in my 20s, the way I tried so hard to blend in and not stick out, I have not done anything in a very traditional way since. And my mum even said that to me. She said, you're rebellious. And I said, I'm not rebellious. I'm the least rebellious person you'll ever meet. And I laughed and she said, no, you don't like tradition. And I actually think that's true. So even despite the glory wall, I was doing what I felt I should do. When Chris and I got together, I understood finally something about myself. It's that I'm not meant for that traditional trajectory and I need to embrace it.
Chris converted to Islam. Is that something that you wanted him to do or expected him to do?
Well, he had to convert in order for us to get married.
He had to convert because to have a ceremony?
Islamically, you can't get married to a non-Muslim man. So it was not even... I never had to ask him, and that's the beautiful thing. I always see what he did anyway as a spiritual act. I always said to him that if this is your choice to be with me and to embrace the religion to any extent, then that's something you have to do. I can't ask you to do that, and I never had to.
What sort of wedding did you two have?
It was you know, it wasn't a traditional Arab wedding, but we had the drums at the beginning and you had Chris's grandmother like banging the drum at the beginning. It was just this really beautiful fusion. So many energies in the room, people of different races and creeds and beliefs, and it was just this amazing experience and day of love. I think especially now when I think about it, how did we get all those people into that one room?
Well, how did his family respond to you and to the fact that he was going to convert to Islam to marry this woman?
I don't know exactly, but his parents are just really incredibly loving people who just want their son to be happy, and they trusted him and they said, if this is what you want, then great. And when they met me, they liked me, and thankfully they've been nothing but supportive people. They're really lovely people.
You don't wear a hijab now, Amal, but you used to. What changed for you?
It was a slow burn change. I don't think anything changed overnight. I wore it completely in full faith that this is what I wanted to do. I'd worn it part-time in high school, so I wore it on the weekends. Eventually got tired of that. It felt really weird, sort of wearing it half the time and not wearing it. It just didn't feel right anymore. So I took it off, and then when I was about 21, I put it back on. And I think towards the end of my 20s, it started to feel like it wasn't reflective of who I was anymore. If we use the word religious, let's say, I probably wasn't as devout as before. To me, personally, it limited the appearance of who I was as well. Like, I was in a profession where engagement with people was core. I was a journalist. And so it was always like this extra obstacle I had to work past to get people to just engage with me on a normal level, because they saw a woman in a headscarf. They didn't see a journalist. But I think it was just a personal choice for me. It wasn't like I suddenly didn't believe in the religion or that it wasn't necessary to wear a headscarf. I think a lot of women who take it off, they go through a lot of searching to find the truth about whether or not the headscarf is necessary. I'm not quite sure. Like, I think there is a lot of evidence to suggest that the hijab is considered compulsory in Islam, and then other people would say it's not. But it just didn't feel right wearing it anymore. And so I gradually changed how I wore it. I thought, well, maybe it's just the way I'm wearing it. So I changed it a little bit. I started wearing it like a, you know, gypsy style headscarf. And then I had the hoop earrings appeared. And then my neck was starting to show a bit more. And then I had to face up to the fact that one day I was looked at and I said, this isn't proper hijab anymore. So I'm not actually doing myself any favors by wearing it. So I took it off and I did it really slowly. I didn't trust the quick taking it off. I felt like that's going to be too scary for me. So I took my time. I just worked my way towards understanding what is it that I don't want to do anymore. And it was that I didn't want to feel that kind of, I don't know, just it just felt a bit too limiting in my mind for the person I was becoming.
In that first decision to wear the veil part-time when you were 15 and then all the time when you were in your early 20s, is that what your family wanted you to do?
My dad encouraged it. Like, my dad was very much keen on it. He didn't force me at all. My mum probably wasn't as sort of interested in me putting it on. She just cared about modesty. My mum doesn't wear like a really traditional headscarf. She sort of wears more a gypsy style, which really suits her. And that's just always how I've known my mum to wear it. So she probably wasn't really super keen on her daughter, who's like, you know, 16 or whatever, wearing this big baggy headscarf. You know, she never tried to push that onto me. But it's definitely like my father was having a conversation with me and said, would you ever think about wearing it? And I think I just thought, yeah, okay, this will be good. Let me do this. I wasn't allowed to do anything else anyway. I might as well be embracing, you know, these aspects of my life.
When you look back at photos of yourself wearing the headscarf from this perspective that you're in now, what do you see?
I see a lot of things. I feel quite emotional when I see those photos, and I really, really want to reach out to that young woman. Because I feel like I was holding myself back in a lot of ways, and it wasn't the headscarf. I know a lot of women who wear a headscarf who live completely fulfilling lives. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding around that. To me, it's a way of dressing. I don't see it as the limitation in itself. But there is something about it. When you wear a headscarf, it says something about who you are. It presents you to the world in a certain way, and I no longer wanted to be presented to the world in a way that would limit how people saw me or how I saw myself. So I look at that photo and I see someone who wanted to please, who wanted to do the right thing, and also I was really overweight, so I really wish I could tell her to eat less chocolate.
What sort of reactions did you get, Amal, when you took the hijab off?
Look, it's funny. The hijab is one of those things that's so emotional for people, and it will really show you where people are in their own lives. So it's a mirror. And when I took it off, I think it was hard for my dad to an extent, because I think he really was always proud of me wearing it. But he said to me, it was your decision to put it on. So it's your decision to take it off. My mother said, yeah, that's great, but just don't change how you dress. She just wanted like the same outfits, but no headscarf. She's like, I understand.
So still dressing modestly.
Yeah, because she just really understood. She said, I understand that in this country it's hard. You never had to go that far anyway and put it on to that extent, but that was the choice I made. And it always was my choice. But the hardest part was more the friendships. There were a couple of friends that kind of just dropped off after that, really did not take it well. They took it very personally, which is
odd. Was it a sort of betrayal of Islam? Or what was the critique that was made against you by friends?
They were extremely angry. Like, do you understand that what you're doing is wrong? Which I always feel is an insecurity on their part. I don't really care what people do. I think the minute I care what somebody's doing, when it doesn't affect me, there's something I need to look at in myself. So I didn't take it personally. It wasn't hugely disappointing because I felt like, well, there's something there that's going on for them that they need to figure out for themselves. I had a couple of friends, though, who they didn't love that I took it off, but they didn't desert me. They just said, oh, well, okay. And one of them, I remember she got emotional the first time she saw me. I think it was hard for her because she loves it so much. And it's like when you know something is beautiful, you want to share it with people. And so I completely understood that the effect it had on her. There are other people just didn't care. There was like, oh, you were a mile with the headscarf before, now you don't wear it. And the other thing that was interesting was one woman said, I really, really opened my eyes to the fact that you are a complex person because you could make that decision, whereas it's very easy to think that women are very simple-minded if they wear the headscarf. And that's the huge misconception, that even the women who do wear the headscarf, I have a really quick story about this. Even me, myself, how quickly I can assume things, you know. I was walking through the Inner West one day and this group of girls all wearing headscarves jumped out of a car, and I thought, oh, they're probably heading to that clothing store that sells really cool cardigans, because cardigan is like the Muslim girl's best friend. And they weren't. They were heading to the donut shop next door and they're pulling out their phones and taking photos of the donuts. And I thought, I'm such an idiot. Like, here I am assuming. It's just this assumption that you're going to make. But the difference was my assumption isn't harmful because I didn't look at them and see them as one-dimensional characters as a result of that. It was just a thing that clicked in my brain and went, oh, if I was them, I'd probably be going there. Yeah, that was sort of, it was very instructive for me to remember that.
We all make those snap judgments.
Well, it's easy to look at someone in a headscarf and think she's not a thinking person, that she's not complex.
And also, I guess for me, it was interesting to hear about someone who decides to take off the headscarf but doesn't stop being a Muslim. It wasn't a rejection of your family or your heritage or your religion. It was something else.
This is the biggest problem, I think. The thing that hurt me more than anything was when people tried to use that against me to say I'm not Muslim anymore, because that to me was hugely damaging and erroneous. Because how dare you take my faith away from me? And let's understand that there's a difference between faith and belief. You know, this is the thing I don't understand about people, I try to understand about people, is that there is a big difference between faith and belief. And a lot of people have belief and they don't have faith. And a lot of people have faith, but they don't know what they believe. They just have faith that there is something out there. And sometimes if you're really, really cool and lucky, you will have both. And the thing about judgment is that it says something about the person judging. It's really never about you. And it was a hard lesson to learn, but it was quite hurtful when years later people would come to me, and I had one particular guy really try to stir me up, you know, by writing to me sort of saying, do you feel bad leaving your religion? But he was trying to be really nice about it. And it was like, I never said once in my life that I've ever left my religion. So, but it was like, you're not a proper Muslim now. I can use this against you. You've written about taking off the headscarf. And it's like, that's a problem for me.
This book, Amal, talks about a journey that you made to the Middle East and around Australia, meeting with Arab women and talking about their lives. What did you want to get out of that research?
I don't know if demystify is the right word, but I almost just wanted to reveal how ordinary we are. I really wanted to just take away this big sort of mystery around Arab women, where they're exoticized or pitied, where there's not much room for complexity in there, and yet our lives are hugely complex. Just because we might have had more restrictions or whatever, it's not about that. It was the big thing that bothered me was that I felt like a lot of people spoke about Arab women or down to them and not sort of, it wasn't their voice coming through. So there were quite a few, there was like a slew of books that came out in the sort of the last decade or so where a non-Arab woman would go to the Arab world and sort of say, I have to find out what's going on here and I need to feel better about this. And it's like, well, good for you, but why? Like, what are you actually achieving? You are not the goalpost for the people living in the Middle East. Their lives are theirs to sort of negotiate and understand better. And I've said this before and I'll say it again, the only people who need to feel better about being Arab are Arabs. I don't live for someone else. However, there was another reason, and I felt like what hadn't been done was, I hadn't read it anyway, if it had been done, was that melding or comparison between the Western Arab experience and the Arab-Arab experience. And just sort of, we're at this really interesting time now where you have a lot of people questioning the migrant experience and should migrants have come here and should we have let them in? And well, my generation, I'm 38, the generations above, below, a lot of us have achieved quite a lot now. And it is quite threatening to some people to see us actually more assimilated than they think they want. They say we want you to assimilate, but actually they don't. So I really wanted to examine, well, what happens to that woman who grows up between these two cultures that are both trying to tell her how to live. A lot of the women I know especially, we all find a point at some stage where we understand ourselves on our own terms. But you'll never take the Arab out of the Arab girl, you know, and I don't think we want that. And I think that's really hard for people to understand. But I also wanted to understand, well, how different is it to be an Arab woman in the Arab world? But I never want to speak on behalf of anyone. I really just, as a journalist, I felt compelled to hold up a microphone and just say, hey, can you tell me what you think? Because people are always telling us what they think you think. And I just met so many amazing women in my life where I thought, well, you're not weak, you're not subjugated, you're not meek. You have, you know, the capacity to speak and make change. And so, like, I just want to throw that open. And the purpose of the book is not to judge or to say that this is right or wrong. It's actually quite, I think one person described it as an offering. And that's how I feel. I feel like it's a platter. And it's like, look, I just want you to see what exists.
Well, on that platter. You make some very different offerings in terms of the countries that you visit, the United Arab Emirates, Lebanon, Jordan, the Palestinian territories, Qatar. How different was the experience of being a woman in those different countries? I mean, are there generalizations you can make across them?
Yeah, it's really different. But the thing is, like, each country has its own set of challenges. So if you go to Palestine, what a woman is going through is completely different to what a woman's going through in Jordan. In Jordan, I felt like each country did have a theme. So Jordan was very much about justice for me. The women there were fighters. They were, like, really interested in improving the lives of women. In Palestine, it was about living under occupation. So how do you, as a mother, protect your children? Or, you know, it's a challenging lifestyle. In Qatar and UAE, there was a lot of focus on education and career, but also family. So I would say that that was quite strong. And then in Lebanon, they were the artists. They were literally one of them was a clown. One was a playwright. You know, these women were just so interesting because they were all trying to make sense of things that don't always make sense.
Palestine is where your parents are from originally. You've been visiting there since you were a kid. Yep. Is it a place that you used to like to go to? What was it like to visit Palestine?
I love going to Palestine. It's challenging. Logistically, it's a very big challenge to get there. But I've always loved it because it was so different. I mean, you've got to imagine these sort of dusty roads, two cars trying to navigate a one-way street. That's what it's like. Back in the day, let's say when I was very young, Palestine was just this exciting other world. It was just crazy. It was so different to Sydney. It didn't have the same technology or the same advancement, I guess, as the society that I'd grown up in. It had a very village-like atmosphere, but also military presence. And so it was totally different to anything I could have imagined. You know, in Sydney, you have it so easy in comparison.
Your husband, Chris, came with you for that trip. What did he make of the Middle East, or what did it make of him?
Oh, he just loved it. He wants to go back as a tourist. He was just... the thing that I warned him about or told him to expect was its frenetic pace. It's chaotic. It's this sort of really strange ordered chaos that just works somehow. And I just said, this is what you need to expect. And so he just felt excited by it because it's otherworldly. The Middle East is so beautiful in the sense that it's so alive. And I think there are so many misconceptions about the Middle East. But the thing that I remember he was really, really, like, the hard thing for him was the hospitality is so deep there to the point of strangers giving you lifts and giving you their numbers. And he just wasn't used to that. And I remember when we got to West Bank, a complete stranger in the taxi we were sharing to get to our destination said, well, we're going to drop you off at your hotel because this taxi driver doesn't know where he's going. And my husband was like, I don't know about this. I don't feel right. Like, we're at this petrol station and this guy's brothers are, like, shoving things out of the back boot for us and, like, to put our bags in. And Chris is like, no. And I was like, just, it'll be fine. We'll be fine. I knew we were safe. And they were lovely. These complete strangers gave us a lift to our hotel, spoke to us about, you know, in Australia, how do people perceive us? And it was really interesting because he just didn't expect that. He also probably expected hostility because he's not Arab. And it was not like that. I said, if Arabs have an issue with anything foreign, it might be the government of a foreign country, but it wouldn't be a foreigner himself or herself. And he was completely welcomed by my family, by strangers. They were curious about him. I probably loved the chaos more when I was younger, and as an adult I found it quite difficult because it just felt very loud and noisy. But sometimes it was just really funny. Like, people just yell over nothing and you just had to laugh. You just had to go, this is what I love about my culture. It's just so raw. It's really in your face. It's just, and so I think for someone like Chris that was very eye-opening, whereas for me it was just like, oh, for God's sake, I just want to get down the street. Can stop talking, or, you know, but it wasn't, I never felt in danger. I felt more frustrated by the logistics of things. Sometimes it was hard to get around. Traffic, just the way people drive, it just was quite nerve-wracking. You know, it's not ordered like Australia.
It's quite different from the eastern suburbs of Sydney.
Well, it's like anywhere in Sydney. Like,
And you made that trip partly to reveal the complexity of lives of Arab women to your Australian readers. Did it change any of your own perceptions or assumptions about what it is to be an Arab woman?
I don't think it changed anything. I think it just heightened my awareness, or perhaps deepened my respect for the work that women are doing there. I actually think women have more control in terms of how they're changing things for other women than people realize. And I hope that the book opens people's eyes to that, because I think these women's voices are the voices that matter right now. Not even mine. My opinion does not matter at the end of the day. I'm not the one on the ground making that change, but the women who are extraordinary people.
You cared a lot when you were growing up, Amal, about being a good daughter. Is that something that still influences you?
Of course. Who doesn't want to be a good daughter? You never want to disappoint your parents. I think I probably challenge them more than most people. I never expected to challenge my parents the way I did, but it was brought to light by someone. Someone gave me an interesting perspective. When I was telling her I was getting engaged to Chris, she said, "Oh, your parents deserve a medal." And I said, "Well, why?" I was the one who had all the restriction, you know. And she's like, "Well, you know, you took off the headscarf and..." They were like, okay, you moved out of home. I moved out with and lived with my brother, but still, I moved out of home before marriage. That was a big, you know, usually it's a big no-no. And they were like, okay. And now you're bringing them an Anglo guy and they're like, okay. And I thought, actually, yeah, they deserve a medal. I think I always care about my parents' happiness and their well-being. One thing that I really observe in my culture especially is you always respect your parents. And it's that you understand especially the sacrifices that they've made for you. And your relationship with your parents, I think for most people, I don't think you have to be Arab or Greek or anything like that to understand that your relationship with your parents is going to shift as you become an adult and you start to see the world differently and their needs change as well. And you're interacting with each other in a new way. And I think that at the end of the day, I always want my parents to be happy. But I also understand that there's a point in life where you have to look and say, well, I'm not living my life for other people. So I have to always be true to myself.
Amal Ahwad, I really enjoyed meeting you. Thank you so much for coming onto Conversations.
Thank you for having me, Sarah.
Amal Ahwad is a journalist and novelist. Her latest book is Beyond Veiled Clichés, Real Lives of Arab Women. Thanks so much for your company today. I'm Sarah Kanoski.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.